thing loaded?
It will be. They're going to be sorry they were ever born.
Who?
All of them. Bobby, I don't want you hanging around me anymore.
What are you mad at me for?
There's going to be trouble.
Chet, why are you doing all this?
You know why? They killed Duke. See, I never knew my father or my mother. All I had was Duke. They took him away and they killed him. What am I supposed to do? Let him kick me too? Yeah, they'd like that. You know that party I was at today at the judge's house? They had things there that cost more than Duke ever begged, borrowed, or stole in his whole life. Any one of those lousy paintings or statues.
You know what you said about needing someone to look up to? Trusting somebody? Well, I guess you're the one I look up to and trust.
You better get out of here.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And if you're a listener, regular listener to the podcast here, Forgotten Horrors, you know that those mellifluous tunes belong to my co-conspirator, Michael H. Price, author of a great many things, which we'll be talking about a little later on, because it's never too early to start shopping for Christmas. But right now, Michael, we've got a show that we want to talk about, a movie we want to talk about, that is one of those that we seem to have done a run of these maybe in the last year or so, that was the films that were really influenced by Psycho, by Hitchcock's Psycho. Psycho was released in September of 1960, and immediately it was like the erotic thrillers in the 80s and stuff. People realized you could shoot something in black and white with a small cast, and if you made it sort of psychosexually weird enough, you could make a little bit of money. And I think that's what happened here with, I don't know how much money they made, but I think that's what happened here with a film called Anatomy of a Psycho, which was released in June of 1961.
Right. And not to forget Otto Preminger's Anatomy of a Murder.
Oh, yes. Yes.
A lot of temptation there to trade on big deal famous titles. We see that occasionally. I think my favorite title ripoff, which had nothing to do with ripping off the film, was or the two films involved. Years later, in the middle 80s, there was a low renter called Raiders of the Living Dead.
Yeah, that was a Sam Sherman thing, wasn't it?
I think that was.
It was Independent International, yeah.
Right.
Did that ever actually come out?
Yeah, perhaps it was largely limited to video.
Right.
But I remember reading about it in Variety, you know, when I was running the movie desk at the newspaper, and I didn't call Sam personally, but called up one of the smaller studio agencies in Dallas, said, when are we going to press screen Raiders of the Living Dead? And the agent just cracked up laughing.
So I guess that was taken as a no then, wasn't it?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, so you've got a combination of Anatomy of a Murder and Psycho here with Anatomy of a Psycho. And it's actually, again, one of those films. It's kind of gritty. It's black and white. It's got a young cast. And it's got some sort of psychosexual content in it, I think it's safe to say. Horror fans will recognize the female lead in it, Pamela Lincoln, because she was the girl in The Tingler, the ingenue in The Tingler, Wim Castle's The Tingler. And Daryl Howe, who was the psycho of the title, was pretty busy there for a while. I think one of the things I discovered on him, he played a character, I think maybe even his first appearance in the movies or television, was as a character named Swivel Hips Jackson in an unsold pilot directed by Ida Lupino, which also had Ida and her husband Howard Duff in it, and Patrick Wayne was in it as well, called Teenage Idol. And it was supposed to be a rock and roll, kind of a rock and roll sitcom.
Okay, that would have been the spinoff of the or the coattail rider of the television movie.
Is that right? Was there was a Teenage Idol television movie?
Yeah, there was indeed. It I've got to refresh myself. I don't know if it's in the American Film Institute catalog. There's a digression for you.
But it was never a theatrical feature then. It was a made-for-TV movie or something.
I recall it as an actual made-for-TV movie at a very early stage.
Mm-hmm.
America didn't get into the making of TV movies. Yeah, it was a spinoff, very close in time to Sing Boy Sing, which which had spun off from an original television, a teleplay, which was pretty much what today we'd call a TV movie.
Right, right.
And there's a lot of fascinating oddities that really have lapsed from popular memory.
Yes, exactly.
From that period.
And we're here to delapse them, too. That's exactly right. So Daryl Howe actually does, I think, a pretty good job as the teenage maniac. And while he, or the teenage psycho, I should say, and while he really is not, doesn't ever go, I don't want to give too much away, but he doesn't exactly go on a murderous rampage, he does account for at least one death. And there's a scene in the picture when he's at the, there's a kind of a class warfare thing going on when he's invited to basically a party given by one of the popular kids, and he ends up really just tearing that whole thing apart, is as scary and unsettling, I think, as any, you know, on screen sort of murder or anything that you'd want to see. And now we want to mention Ronnie Burns, who is the titular star, not the titular star, but the name above the title, the first name in the cast, who was at the time just coming off of George Burns and Gracie Allen's show. He was their adopted son. And after this picture, he didn't make any more movies, and he ended up, I believe, getting into real estate. But he is the second male lead, actually, in this, and is the one, if I can do a very quick synopsis, Daryl Howe's character is very attached to his brother. Whose brother is gone to the electric chair for a crime that Daryl Howe's character is sure that his brother did not commit. Of course he did. And Pamela Lincoln is the girlfriend of Pamela Lincoln's character's girlfriend of Ronnie Burns's character. And basically what this is all about is the unraveling of the psycho, the lead character, who is convinced that his brother was unjustly executed and lashes out against the system as people did in those days.
Oh yeah, it is a crime melodrama in the literal sense, but it's really more a fairly sobering study of a deteriorating mind.
I agree.
You find there are horrific elements of Howe wears a really uncomfortable looking scar makeup.
Yes, he does. He does.
Reminds me of Bruce Cabot in Let 'Em Have It,
mm-hmm.
the 1935 picture where he gets his face altered only to find that the plastic surgeon has carved his initials into his face.
That's right.
The very, very like cringe-inducing makeup on Daryl Howe in this picture. And an attitude, whether or not Ed Wood had anything to do with it, some say he did, some say he didn't. Actually, the story generates from Jane Mann, who was the director's partner.
That's right. And the music cues. Now there are music cues from Plan 9 from Outer Space, which people have used to bolster their argument that Ed Wood had something to do with the picture. Now, some say he wrote the screenplay under the pseudonym, or co-wrote the screenplay under the pseudonym Larry Lee. But what I've been able to find is that Larry Lee was actually a real guy named Lawrence C. Lieberman. And
yes, and Larry Lee had hands in a lot of filmmaking aspects besides writing.
Right.
Small parts, produced musical scores for small films, and he had credentials dating as far forward as the early 90s, including set dresser credits on one of the Nightmare on Elm Street pictures.
Right, and he's not Ed Wood. And the other co-writer that you see often is Don Devlin. And Don Devlin's a real guy, too, who actually has a part as one of the gang, one of Daryl Howe's gang in the picture. And he's Dean Devlin's dad, right? He's the Dean Devlin did what, Independence Day and Stargate and all those big budget things. He's a real guy. You know, it was when I started trying to run down this rumor that Ed Wood had something to do with Anatomy of Psycho's writing, I look at Jane Mann and I think, what a perfect pseudonym for Ed Wood, given his cross-dressing tendencies, right? Jane Mann. It was perfect. And then, of course, we found out, as you mentioned earlier, that Jane Mann was actually either the girlfriend or the wife of Brooke L. Peters, I've just lost his real name, Boris Petrov.
Boris Petrov,
yeah. So she's a real person. So I'm just not sure where the Ed Wood connection came. Now, I will say that a couple of years later, Ed Wood and Petrov and Pamela Mann, Jane Mann. Sorry, dropped into X-rated films from the 70s, The Private Afternoons of Pamela Mann, completely different picture. Jane Mann all combined on that film with, what is that, Shotgun Wedding who was it? Who was the actor in that? The good old character actor.
Shotgun Wedding?
Shotgun Wedding,
that
yeah.
That would be Pat O'Malley.
Pat O'Malley, yeah. Right. And they were all together on that. And, of course, Jane Mann then worked with Petrov on The Unearthly as well.
Which is an unfairly neglected picture.
It is, and you know, I've seen people say, well, you know, there was a Ed Wood influence in that too, because Tor Johnson's character is named Lobo, just like he is in Bride of the Monster. So you can drive yourself nuts running this stuff down that, you know, there's two dozen of us out here.
Underbelly of Hollywood scene.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's probably Petrov or Brooke Peters, to use his working name, probably he was the most successful of that in cracking the semi-major leagues.
Yes, he was. He had some Allied Artists pictures. Of course, Bride of the Monster had a not a major release, but it had a – who was Bride of the Monster AIP? Did they do that?
No. That was a small change company. I would have to look that up.
Yeah. I was trying to think. Maybe they almost sold it to Arkoff and Nicholson. I can't remember, but it seemed like
I just happened to have cracked the American Film Institute catalog of motion pictures.
Okay.
Actually, Bride of the Monsters was underwritten by a meatpacking company.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that was the male lead in Bride of the Monster was the son of the owner
right.
of the meatpacking company, Tony McCoy, I believe was his name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a meatpacking company, but it seemed like I thought AIP released that on a double bill, and I could be very wrong about that.
I would have to dig deep there.
Well, I'm going to ask our producer, Joey Hambrick. Joey, can you check that out and see who released Bride of the Monster at some point?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead and get on. You know, these kids.
I associated with a company called Rolling M Productions.
Right, which was the production company, but I'm trying
right.
to think who released it. So anyway, as Joey looks that up for us, we'll go on and talk about Anatomy of a Psycho, and there's another character in it called Lieutenant Mac, who seems to be pals with all of the guys. In a place called the Shack, where they all hang out and apparently just play cards and stuff. And Lieutenant Max always dropping by and visiting with him. He's a guy named Michael Granger. And Michael,
oh, yeah, sure.
yeah, who was the, if you remember, Creature from the Atom Brain, Michael Granger was the gangster who gets deported and gets with a scientist and figures out how to make zombies to attack the people that have put him away, and that's Granger. So here he's got like a sympathetic cop role, which is what he most often played, were kind of these sort of hard bitten cop roles. Did you find what that was? Joey says it is
distributed or. Production company is Rolling In.
Yeah, it is Rolling In. Banner. Yep. Banner Pictures distributed.
Oh, Banner. Okay.
So you are correct. Who was Banner, Michael?
That I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
I can't
We'll
either.
Have to store that away for,
We'll store that away for another time. Yeah. You know, one of the things that's very interesting about this picture, about Anatomy of a Psycho, it references the Crime and Punishment movie, which if I'm remembering right, that was Anthony Perkins, right? In the Crime and Punishment movie in the 60 or 61, whenever that was?
Would that be, you mean the trial?
Yeah, well, Crime and Punishment USA, I believe.
Okay,
would
sure.
Would that be right? Joey's frantically punching the button now. So is that Crime and Punishment USA? Am I right on that, Joey? I think it's Crime and Punishment USA. I believe it was Anthony Perkins, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, 1959.
1959. It was before Psycho.
George
yeah.
Hamilton?
Yeah. George Hamilton.
Yeah.
Sorry, it was George Hamilton, not Anthony Perkins at all. Yeah,
easy to get those guys confused.
I know. Anthony Perkins is the one without the tan. Believe us, how we could tell them apart. What's your basic reading on this picture?
It's really a culture clash picture.
Yes.
I think fueled by the resentment of the lower echelons of Poverty Row toward polite society. You see that throughout the history of the lower budget studios. You find the pretensions to artistry in that immediate late 50s, early 60s community that includes Brooke Peters and of course Ed Wood. I really think it's a have-nots attacking the haves
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and blaming the social ills upon the ruling class,
mm-hmm. which really comes to a head in the scene in which, or I say the extended scenes in which the psycho of the title goes to the party at that beautiful by the pool out in the mountains. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful setting, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you can tell that not only does he not belong, he knows he does not belong.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And there is, and I won't give it away for people who might want to see the picture, which, Joey, is the picture available on YouTube, or how do you get the picture?
We watch it on YouTube, but there's a Vinegar Syndrome release.
Vinegar Syndrome? Beautiful. Vinegar Syndrome.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Release of it. Yeah, yeah. And it's, I won't say what he does with a cigarette, and it's, to me, that is the defining moment of the picture when he takes a cigarette as he's outside the bedroom of his girlfriend, who is aspiring for higher things. And it's a very interesting picture in a lot of ways. Although, you know, sometimes you can't shake the idea that this is like some of these things are like acting class assignments, right? You know, they're like scenes, you know? Did you get that feeling at all?
It's got that jumbled quality.
Mm-hmm.
It seems it's not supposed to be episodic, but it feels that way. There is no what we call the novelistic arc in this picture.
No, you're right.
There's a beginning, a middle, and an end, but all the interim pieces seem to have been shot without much knowledge. It's almost as though they were writing the thing as they went along.
It almost is, and it's also like very anticlimactic at the end.
Yeah.
It doesn't end so much as it just sort of runs out of steam, you know.
Well, you know, they had to roll their own because no major studio would touch them.
That's right, and this was a small studio again that released a small releasing company. I'm sure a states' rights organization that released this picture, and I don't know how well it did. It's entertaining even today. And it's worth watching, I think, for the performances and also, as you say, for kind of the class warfare and the whole deal,
which is the whole.
And I never thought of extending that to the filmmakers themselves, but I think you're on to something there.
You notice in the early talking pictures from Poverty Row, a lot of anger is directed at Wall Street.
Yes.
The ruling class, the privileged moneyed class, 13th Guest from the early 30s comes to mind immediately, because one of the big set pieces in the picture is when all these high society swells are thrown into jail on suspicion of murder and have to rub elbows with the scum of the earth. You know what I mean? These fat cats are just appalled. That wouldn't have come from MGM.
Well, you're right. And what was the one? What was the one on the ocean liner that we did a while back? That from that era, from the early 30s, where everybody on the ocean liner dies.
Terror aboard was that?
Terror aboard. Yeah, I believe that was right. Yeah, and it's the same thing, right? I mean, you've got people who can afford to buy this kind of a ship to bring all of the, just for a lark, to bring all of the rich folks aboard. You're right. And 13 women, I think, would be another one.
Now that's the have-nots getting even with the haves in a big way.
Exactly. And this picture in its own way is that as well, isn't it? I never really thought about that before. I thought it was just like this psycho, you know? I mean, there you go.
You can tell they started off with intentions of ripoff, the very title. You know, it's none too subtle references to two large famous pictures.
On the other hand, the very first scene is a noirish scene, very much so, with the guys throwing the newspapers off of the truck. I mean, and you're right. I mean, they did. It's like we've talked so much on these podcasts. I'm sure people may be getting sick of it, but it's about Corman and the idea. And I think you and I in our careers have also kind of put this into play. Corman realized that when he was making the drive-in films, and of course Stephanie Rothman and the others that worked with him, if they had some starlet pop or top every 10 pages, they could say all kinds of polemic in a picture.
Right.
And so if you've got a picture named Anatomy of a Psycho, and you're as long as you have some sort of psycho action, which this one does, you can also pursue a greater theme, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's this is a common thread throughout Brooke Peters' pictures. The official powers that be luring people or patients without known relatives to mm-hmm. this forbidden clinic in the unearthly.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, they gotta be nobodies
mm-hmm.
because nobody will miss them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's basically, you know, H.G. Wells nailed it with the Morlocks and the time machine. But
right.
So many of these low rent pictures treat the privileged class as the Morlocks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which it looks to me like this one does too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the Morlocks trying to also, the Morlocks picking off the women from the Eloi, right, in this particular case.
Well, yeah, exactly.
And there's that, the
never whole, mind that the executed brother is probably guilty as all get out.
Yeah, he's guilty of sin, yeah. But there's that great
sin. But
it's
his execution that triggers the rampage.
That's right.
Or is not necessarily the trigger, but it's the last straw.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, like, what did Popeye say? That's all I can stand because
I can't stand no more. And then there's the girl who has become the plaything of the wealthy man
mm-hmm.
who's trying to who's been the consort, and that's really handling a very sort of basic and direct way that Daryl Howe, and I cannot remember her name. I'm going to have to reach over here and get my the blonde woman who I thought, Judy Howard was her name.
Sure.
And she, and you know, it was very obvious that they were romantically entangled, shall we say. And then when she's trying to step up and it's not enough anymore for her to be with the Daryl Howe character, and that's part of it as well. It's very interesting in a lot of ways. It mirrors a lot of you think of for what is it? Day of the Dead? Is that the one? Is it Day of the Dead, Joey? Joey's looking at me. I'm getting it wrong. It's the one that has.
Are you thinking of
Dennis Hopper and John Leguizamo?
Land of the Dead. Yeah, that's Romero's Steinbeck movie.
Right, exactly.
Basically, it's the Grapes of Wrath interleaved with Of Mice and Men.
Well, the Grapes of Wrath with the Joes being zombies.
Yes.
Yeah, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which I think is a brilliant picture, Land of the Dead. And and this is kind of the same in some ways. It's a lot the same thing. He is so, you feel so sorry for this psycho, who is a complete fish out of water. You know this is not going to end well when he shows up at this estate that has a live band playing, you know, playing 50-ish kinds of pop music around the pool.
Mm-hmm.
You know it's just not going to end well for any of them. And he almost becomes, in that way, our viewpoint character.
Right.
You know, Ronnie Burns is a secondary character, really, in a lot of ways.
Well, that's the beauty of these little unafraid, nothing-to-lose pictures. They can cause the viewer to feel almost a forbidden sympathy
mm-hmm.
with someone that in real life they probably wouldn't want to ride on the same elevator car with.
That's exactly right. Well, we'd like to recommend you take a look at it, and you can see it. Vinegar Syndrome has it, and I'm sure in a wonderful print because those people do very good work at Vinegar Syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
So we would like to recommend that you take a look at it. And we would like to now talk about a couple of things. Number one is, you know, it's never too early to do your Christmas shopping. And Michael and I just happen to have something for everybody on your list, assuming they enjoy listening to the Forgotten Horrors podcast. And Michael, what's out there for you right now? You got that King Kong book out there, right?
Well, we've got the new expanded edition of George Turner's book, The Making of King Kong, which I have kept updating and revising according to George's notes,
right,
intending a revision. That was stymied by his death in 1999,
yes.
But of course, you don't drop a ball just because the originator cashes in. And of course, new information keeps coming to light on that 1933 film, And then it seems King Kong keeps reincarnating himself in the at the movies.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we've got a handsome new edition out from a publisher called Pulp Hero Press, and very pleased to see that out. It seems to be riding pretty high at Amazon. Not to detract from yours and my new book, Fantasies in the Sand.
No, not
altogether
at all.
Different from King Kong.
It is, and I think probably it doesn't cost all that much just to pick them both up. It's Fantasies in the Sand. Of course, we look at the Beach Party films as fantasies, and we kind of go back. And you know, I'm hearing some very good stuff about the book, and I'm very happy that people are picking it up and commenting on it. One of the people who commented on Amazon.com said, "It's a dangerous book because every time I open it up, I lose 2 hours of my life." And that's a great thing. We're happy for that. It's again about the Beach Party movies, but we also take it back, and it's very brilliant. I think what you do at the very beginning is to start it with the wild women pictures of the 30s and 40s, and then we kind of fold into all of that the sarong pictures of the 1940s, the World War II era, when a lot of the GIs were seeing, you know, tropical isles for the first time, being basically the ancestors of the Beach Party, or the generation right before the Beach Party pictures. So,
right.
Fantasies in the Sand is the name of it. They're both popularly priced, I think, the King Kong book and Fantasies in the Sand. And I also want to mention your book, your deep in the horrors of Texas book, which is
Volume 2. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh dear, that's about as close as we've ever come to making a true underground comic book.
It is very. It has the spirit of the undergrounds, and not just because you have what I know. You have Jack Jackson is prominently in it.
Who, good old Jack, yeah.
Yeah, what a wonderful guy he was, and you have a couple of other underground guys in it as well.
Oh, Greg Irons, of course, Rand Holmes illustrating your
that's right.
splendid story about the. The devil on the plains.
That's right. That's exactly right. And we want to remind, just in case there's anyone within the sound of my voice who doesn't have this book yet, which may not be true, but we have coming up, as the holiday season comes up, I would like for you to consider Hardboiled Christmas Stories, Tales of Yuletide Homicide, from the 1930s and 1940s pulps, and I wrote a new Dan Turner Hollywood detective story for it as well. And all of these things are on Amazon.com. What else you got out there, Michael?
Oh, man, what don't we?
What don't we?
I mentioned I'm breaking in a new publisher right now.
Right.
And they keep asking for, well, what else you got? What else you got? So there'll be a new anthology of short fiction coming up presently.
Good.
In the meantime, we've got the third volume of Roadkill, Texas Horror by Texas Writers.
Mm-hmm.
And I dropped in an amiable little trifle of a, I don't know if it's a horror story, but it certainly is weird, called The Man from Planet X.
I remember that story. I've seen that story.
Yeah, based on a true experience my father had when he received a phone call from somebody claiming to be calling from Planet X near Earth. And it's like, how did that really happen? Well, it was a simple misperception.
Right.
The guy was with his Texas drawl saying Plant X near Earth, Texas. But my dad was not in the mood for what he construed as a practical joke.
Right, right.
It's like, well, that's been an old favorite family story since the 1950s, I guess. And so I said, okay, let's flesh this out and turn it into a piece of fiction. So there you go.
And what is the name of that new collection?
It's called Roadkill. Volume 3.
So if you look up Michael Price or myself, John Woolley, on Amazon.com, you can pretty much fill up your Christmas list, we'll guarantee it, with books and downloads and all sorts of stuff. And, of course, we appreciate the support very much, and we appreciate your listening. And we appreciate people like Chris Mounts, who came on our Facebook page, which is, what is it,
the
Joey?
Forgotten Horrors Podcast Facebook Group.
Forgotten Horrors Podcast Facebook Group, thank you. And came on and asked, it had a request, asked if for the next time, our next podcast, we would do Mummy's Boys with Wheeler and Woolsey.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you and I both love, of course, we're the, and this, we've done this before on the show, talked about this before, but the idea that whenever a certain franchise, or not franchise is not the correct term, or maybe in some cases, but
a series of pictures
was sort of dying out. The formula was just add monsters. And in this case, Mummy's Boys is a horror comedy, which we love horror comedies here at the Forgotten Horrors Podcast. And we like Wheeler
Mummy's
and Woolsey
Boys,
a lot,
yeah.
too.
Yeah. Now, Wheeler and Woolsey, you can hardly go wrong with those guys.
That's right. That's right.
A lot of great comedy teams that nobody seems to remember anymore. Everybody's all Marx Brothers, Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy, this and that. But you get into the deeper cuts, if you'll pardon the expression, mm-hmm. on the comedy team tradition, and you find Wheeler and Woolsey, Olsen and Johnson, the Ritz Brothers,
Alan Carney,
Brown and Carney,
yeah.
who indeed had their own separate careers, but worked most effectively as a team. The critical and popular consensus is, yeah, aren't these guys kind of also-rans? Aren't they lay it on a little bit thick? Well, yeah, and that's probably what we like about them.
That's right. That's exactly.
But yeah, Mummy's Boys would be a splendid thing. And gosh, and then heck, we could do a Forgotten Horrors horror comedy podcast.
You know, we could do that, couldn't we? And we, you know, we're wondering if Chris Mounts is within the sound of our voice. Chris, we'd like to know, Mounts is an unusual enough surname that wondering if you are any relation at all to Bill Mounts. Michael and I both being Western swing fans, Bill Mounts was a drummer who had a band record a lot of records for Bluebird in the 40s. And wondered if by any chance you might be a relative of Bill Mounts's. And if you're not, that's fine. We're going to do the film anyway, and we thank you for asking us about it.
Yeah, I love it when the audience takes part.
Absolutely, we do. And, Michael, it's been great, and we'll be talking to you again in a month or so. And thank you, everybody, for listening to the show, for responding on the Facebook page. We just really appreciate it very much. We're very glad to be doing it. And if you feel like supporting us by buying our books, we're doubly glad to have you listening.